Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome. I'm extremely excited to be involved in motion pictures in any way, but this one is particularly fascinating. I was involved with director John Wells in helping kind of make the reality of the script work and the food scene seem legitimate and relatively current. What you'll see is a pretty legitimate replication of what it's like to work in a high-end fancy kitchen, except it's done by movie stars that you're going to recognize. Now, they did a fabulous job in, you know, hair and makeup and wardrobe, but fundamentally what you're seeing is kind of the raw nature of what real restaurant work and what creating this food is. So without further ado, I'm going to bring out the cast, and then we'll talk about it. So first up, Sam Keeley. Next, Uma Thurman.
Uma.
Bradley Cooper. Sienna Miller. And Daniel Brewer. So this is just like Sunday supper at my house. We hang out, like, we talk a little stuff about business, and we really get down to what we're looking for. The question for the general cast is, what initially attracted any of you to this project? Do you actually like food?
Very much.
Excellent.
Yeah, it turned out that we were all pretty into food by coincidence, and we were kind of around this incredible food as we were cooking, and we were being fed it. So that was a huge perk of doing this film.
And actually the cast, the fact that it was always going to be conceived as an international cast was very alluring, that we shot in London. That was a really cool aspect, and very true to kitchens, as you know. You know, there's always tons of different languages going on, and
right.
it was a really awesome aspect of it.
Did you learn anything, in all of the intensive practice, was there anything that you learned as either a maitre d', a chef, a cooker, or a critic that you were surprised by or otherwise perplexed? Or was it also obvious, or are there nuances that you guys understood or started to capture?
Well, I was attracted by the film because I opened a restaurant myself 5 years ago because my acting skills are so bad, my acting skills and my cooking skills are so bad that I decided to open a proper place. And what I learned is that we are very far away from getting a Michelin star. The perfection, the level of you know, the quality in this restaurant where I was trained, Marcus Waring's restaurant in London, is just incredible.
Right. And it's fastidious. I mean, you know, you did a very good job of capturing kind of the exasperation with the talent and yet your complete faith behind it, which was evident without being so spoken so often. So it was really very real, because that's how the front of the house treats a lot of us cooks. Like, yeah, all right, have your little fit. But come on. You did great that way.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I was really interested in it. So in terms of being the critic, Uma, you walk in with a brilliant and supercilious way that I imagine you go to a lot of places. And when they bow down to you, you did such a great job. Was it hard to pretend to be a critic, or was it a natural thing? No, I mean that, because when you're talking about food, she talked about food in the right way. It wasn't like it was just like blah, blah, blah.
Well, it was just a lot of fun to, the cast was assembled to join everybody. But I liked the exasperation with Twitter and Yelp. I thought that was funny. The idea that the irritation that the crowds, the popular demand was over superseding opinion.
Right.
Do you feel, this question is good for you actually as a professional in the arena. Did we capture the...
Well, completely, because the pressure is so on, and as much as the social media forms a lot of the general opinion, it's still the main critic of the New York Times or of the London Standard or the papers that people read that really give you your bona fides. Like, you can have a lot of Yelps and people are like, yeah, whatever, those are all your cousins and we know it. And that doesn't diminish the value of Yelp to a consumer who's traveling around the world. But when you have 4 stars here or 3 stars in Michelin, you can, it's kind of like, F you to anybody who ever challenged you as a critic, like you, or as a chef. You can say, look, whatever you think, here's the paper of record saying exactly what matters to us. So that's a really big part of our business. And as the young chefs try to figure out how their part of the piece Sam, your character is a testament to just how hard they've got to work and how much apparent suffering they have to do. Was that part of your situation?
Yeah, I guess so. I spent a lot of time in Marcus Waring's restaurant in the Barclay and studied one chef in particular and kind of watched him and learned his story and about where he came from. And these guys are in it because they're so passionate, you know, because they work insane hours, obviously, as you know, and, you know, for very little money, and because they just want to get it right, you know, they love the food and the whole thing behind it. And I studied this one guy, Jake, who was younger than me, but it was Marcus's, like, right-hand man. He would run the kitchen when Marcus wasn't around, but it was just fascinating to see.
Oh, yeah, I remember that guy.
Yeah, he was, like, really kind of, like, quiet kind of kid, yeah. But when he switched it on, he was just this animal in the kitchen, you know. But, yeah, they're all covered in burns and, you know, slash marks from knives. And, yeah, exactly.
Still have them either. Just every now and then something tricky can happen. Mm-hmm. Well, so did you, in the screaming and passionate scenes that Bradley did so well. did it feel like you were being yelled at, guys?
Yes.
I mean, Sienna mostly? That embarrassing turbo situation? you guys are actors, so you know what's going on, but how did that capture anything in the Waring kitchen? I imagine he's a little calmer than maybe our script led everyone to believe. Is that true?
He probably has his moments, but it has leveled out.
Right.
I think he can definitely go there.
Well, I think what happens as chefs mature, they realize that yelling is not the most effective way to change the behavior of the people that are working with you. And in fact, a quiet lecture delivered sotto voce, yet within earshot of the people that you work with, might shame you more and quicker. Because when I yell at it, or when I used to yell at someone, I would always have to go back and apologize, because I felt like an idiot. And then, of course, I diminished everything I just yelled about to a whimpering little apology. So effectively, the yelling was such a crucial part of it. I mean, Bradley, you felt pretty jacked up about it because you did the throw pretty well on that. Mm. Did you talk to Marco about that, Marco Pierre White at all about that?
I did, yeah. And Marcus and Claire Smythe at Hospital Road,
right.
and Gordon Ramsay. So I just watched.
Who was actually the PhD student of all PhD students of yelling chefs, right?
But what's so interesting, I just love the family of it all because you worked under Marco, so did Gordon, and so did
right.
Marcus.
Right.
So, you know, and I think Marco, and he will say it openly, has changed a lot over the years and has calmed down a lot. But no, there's tons of stories which you know more than anybody of. But, you know, I think the movie was actually pretty tame.
Well, compared to Marco's worst days, yes.
Yeah.
But I think it captured probably more the 21st century vibe. Right?
Yes.
I mean, that was
yes.
1985.
Right.
And, you know, Marco would literally take scissors and cut guys' chef coats
right.
like, while they were on them.
Right.
Like, you don't deserve this. Snip, snip, snip. Yeah. What crazed mind comes up with this way of torturing people is such a cool thing. And yet, the pressure and the intensity, when the Michelin guide is in there, I think, without wrecking the movie, there's a scene where there's some sabotage that is so well done and so well thought out that it's just like, wow, that's a payoff. And I think it's great.
And also, I always thought that, you know, the how erratic that the Adam character comes in the kitchen, it's all geared towards himself. I mean, it really is all, it's all based in self-loathing that he screwed it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, right, and that's fundamentally why chefs yell, because they realize they didn't train their staff properly. The reason they're mad is because they should have known to train them for the inevitable fact that at 7:30 you have to move much faster than you do at 5:30. You have to accept a window of acceptable variation. And if you don't do that, you're mad at them, but they're just like 17-year-old kids or 22-year-old kids. You have effed up.
Right.
And you feel so bad about it, you're lashing at everybody they can. How was the food on set?
Unbelievable.
Like, you ate their real food?
Oh, we were cooking. I mean, we were cooking in the way that they set it up. Marcus created the dishes, and then we would have recipes. The meals were all set by the commies, and then all of the other cooks were actually...
Commies are not Soviets, they're
all the other cooks, they were not extra actors. They were cooks, the people that work in Michelin star restaurants around London. So we were cooking the food, so we were eating the food, too. Ricardo was, oh, yeah, all the time. We were testing constantly, but then we would actually, in between takes, eat a lot of the meat. Ricardo was just doing brilliant work in the grill.
The tacos,
good because the catering wasn't that good.
Yeah. So.
It was all relevant.
The greatness of craft services all over the world. But they're not 3-star Michelin restaurants, right? So did anybody take home any recipes that they're going to cook at their house now?
Turbot. I have eaten much more turbot than I ever thought I would, and can fillet it, which is exciting.
Right.
So I can buy a whole one and take it home, and that's like a good new skill. And also, I can make pasta, so I've been making.
You did an amazing scene pasta. Where you were rolling it out with such aplomb. I'm like, she.
Yeah, and she really did it. Yeah. She really did that in the scene. Yeah. Yeah, that was fantastic.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, it really was. People have no idea how hard that is to act, number one, but then make pasta while you're acting.
Because at that point, she wasn't acting. She was just...
Yeah, just
I
doing
was
it.
Just being, man.
And that, but that was the sort of wonderful thing for all of us, is that we were actually got to do the work. And that's for an actor, that's always the easiest right. thing, if you're actually doing it.
Well, so when the chefs that were actually helping you execute the mise en place...
Yeah.
Were they the same ones every day, or were they...
Same ones.
Oh, so they didn't have a job for a month.
That's right.
Like, they were
That's right, they all came,
you.
Yeah. Oh, it felt like a real brigade.
Yeah.
That's exactly
yeah.
what it really
yeah.
feels
yeah.
like.
Yeah, and everybody got to know each other. And, for example, when we had with that scene where Adam berates everybody, you know, they're all there.
Right.
You know, and it really was...
And they're like, yes. Somebody else is taking it right now. Right? I mean, you know...
Cause silently,
when
absolutely.
When that stuff goes on, that's all you're really thinking about, is you're just trying to get as close to the corner and as away right. from the center of attention as possible.
Of course.
Because, I mean, obviously, when someone makes a mistake, the whole kitchen pays for it. How much of awareness do you now have in a dining experience when you're sitting at a restaurant table? Like, will you ever, when you see... Like, here's what happens in my family. We'll finish our appetizers, and we'll be done. And for 5 minutes, they'll watch us. And then a busboy will come up surreptitiously, quietly, getting ready to clear the table. And for some strange reason, my wife or my son picks a little something up off the plate. And the whole team has to back out again. Because you can't clear the table while they're still eating.
Yeah.
So do you ever notice anything about that in restaurants when you're going around?
The thing that I heard that was the most extraordinary thing was that if you're a table, obviously, of people, five of you, and you've ordered different things, and your main courses are ready and they're on the pass, if someone from that table stands up to go to the bathroom and it takes more than 2 minutes, every dish has to be thrown away.
Chucked.
So I just, if I'm at a dinner table and there are people, I'm like, if we're waiting, you do not leave the table. Just stay there.
Right.
That was like...
Well, I mean, in New York now, because you have to go like 400 yards away from the restaurant to have a cigarette. Like, right. It could be a month before they come back.
That's
and like,
true.
You know, like a delicate piece of fish can't hold on 2 minutes. Certainly a ravioli can't either. Like,
right.
You've got to throw it out and restart
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
It's
I never thought about the smoking thing. You're right. This has got to be a nightmare.
Yeah. But they go so far away.
Yeah, it's got to be a nightmare.
Because we made them go so far
right,
away.
Right.
I guess you have to go to Washington Square Park the very same. Can't possibly smoke in front of this. My guests are very upset with you. So now what do you think about when you have to wait a few more minutes at a reservation?
Boom.
You guys never wait for reservations.
Not with you, Mario.
Yes.
Well done.
But is there any sympathy toward the situation? I mean, you guys have seen it now from a very different way. I would say that among the people at this table, all of you have, in any of my restaurants, have always been incredibly respectful and most delightful. So you're welcome back at any time.
Thank you.
But there are people that throw a little fit, and they tend not to be the famous people. They tend to be the entitled people. Have you ever seen anything like that in a restaurant? And will you ever, in the restaurant's defense, come up to them and say, please?
It'd be weird to get involved at that point.
Right.
With like a complete stranger. But like, they definitely get a bad look.
Right. That's good. That's good enough. That's good enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember when I was a kid, I remember being at a seafood restaurant, and then the guy actually did it to me. I was a prep cook, and then he asked me what I put in the crab cakes, and I didn't understand what he was saying, and I was like, well, because he really wanted me to say as many ingredients as possible to tell me that my crab cakes weren't well made, because the more you put in them,
right.
the worse it is.
Anything besides crabs already mistaken.
Exactly, yeah. And I thought, what an asshole.
So he didn't trip you up, though.
No, I didn't really answer him, and then he just explained how smart he was about food. Yeah.
That's something about New York and London, I imagine that.
No Although this was Summers Point, New Jersey.
Obviously, a training ground for New York. That's where they're learning how to be New York. Let's go down and embarrass the busboy at the crab place first and see how it feels. Right? Oh, yeah, I did great. Let's go get on the train and be tough to somebody.
Right.
Now we're in Manhattan. All right.
Here we go.
So as you go out to eat, I mean, at the fancy Michelin star restaurants, a lot of the trade is in the tasting menu. And the
the Michelin critic's alleged behavior, which we have yet to be able to figure out as well as you guys did in the movie. But are you more prone to order tasting menus or a la carte now?
Tasting menus.
It's a tasting.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And why is that? Because?
The experience. You want the whole experience. I mean, if you don't have the time, obviously, it depends. But if you're going to go to a restaurant that has that option, you've gone to a really great place, you might as well commit. Well,
it would be like going to the theater and say, you know, I don't want to see Hamilton, I'd like to see Kinky Boots, please.
When you're there.
That's what I'm saying, when you're there. You're like, actually, tonight...
Can I skip the second act? I'm really a little tired.
Yeah, just a couple of monologues from an old coward thing, and then we'll be good.
That's hilarious. All right, so I
don't know where Hamilton and Kinky Boots came up with that. How random.
You're going to be angry.
For one of those. All right, so that's enough of my questions. Let's hear what you guys have to ask. Start with you.
Thank you. Brad, you do an amazing job of...
There's a microphone.
You do an amazing job of conveying your character's complex inner life. How
Thank
did you,
you
relate to him personally? What did you draw on inside of you to
Well, I mean, I had a tremendous amount of research and being able to speak with people in that world. And then, you know, just the script was fantastic. If I had to relate to anything, you know, that idea of trying to have a goal that you're setting out to do and an obsession to do the best you can at that, I can definitely relate to that. But I think more than any other character I've played, I really relate. I saw how different I was from this guy because he lost the joy in what he did, and that's a hell of a thing to lose. As you, I'm sure you concur, because food is so joyful, and if you've lost joy in cooking, then wow, you are lost. And that's where he is for so much of the movie. And then characters like Helene really sort of re-inject him with the thing that he lost back in Paris.
I have one question before the rest. My wife wants to know, she knows you didn't shuck a million oysters, but did you shuck 10 of those oysters?
Oh, probably 60.
Because she said, I saw a lot of arms without any body, so I'm assuming that it was a prep cook.
No, that was me.
It was you.
Yeah, there's no double in the whole movie.
I told her.
Yeah. But in fact, they did this thing where the guy loosened about 10 of them in the beginning. But we got through them in like half a take. So I was like, oh.
All right, I better go.
And I had this stupid idea that I'd bring the bag out, which wasn't pre.
Right. Look good, though. Look good.
No, it was good. But right. But I was so lucky. That was the first day of shooting. And I mean, as you know, because I have shucked oysters and I was a prep cook. And if you're ever going to slice your hand, it's shucking an oyster. And I really thought, I even said to John, I said, bro, I mean, just to let you know, this goes south.
We got 2 weeks.
You better find a lot of other stuff to shoot.
Yes, sir.
I want to congratulate each of you for the emotional integrity of your performances. The food aside, I wanted to throw my microwave out when I came home. But I wanted to ask Ms. Miller and Mr. Cooper, this is a film on many levels of recovery and also reinvention. And I'd like to go out of the kitchen for a moment and just both of you talk about how you saw your character and going through the different phases, particularly Mr. Cooper with the recovery. It was not just from substance abuse, it was from a lot of other things too.
Well, in terms of what I was just commenting on before, you know, I think that we find this guy, he's white-knuckling it, you know. He pitches to Tony, you know, how he's has all the answers, and he knows exactly what he's going to do. But he has absolutely no clue, really, because he's the same guy he was, just minus all the things that he did to inoculate himself from his emotions. So you're sort of watching this guy just actually spiral even further and further down in the movie, the way that I saw it.
For me, I really liked the humanity of this character and how honest it was. She's a single mother. She's doing her best. She's passionate about cooking, but she's juggling a lot of balls, and everything seems to be compromised at a certain point, and she's trying her best. And I just think that it was, you know, I wanted it to be a very real person. I didn't want to wear makeup or kind of portray it in any inauthentic way possible, because the women that I've met that work in these kitchens, it's a very male-dominated environment. They have to be really tough and strong, and you know, she's got depth and she's got pain, and And it resonated.
What was it like to have to say, yes, chef, when everything inside you wanted to say, go fuck yourself?
I think that's the nature of being in a kitchen. I think that's something that a lot of lesser, anyone but the head chef would have experienced. Yeah. We chef.
I thought the movie had a lot. It was very much like a sports film in another way, in that it had the sort of arc of, you know, the comeback story, the competition. Did any of you feel the same way? And did you at all think about it in terms of that sort of? And you, of course, experienced it with the chef television shows and all. Could you talk about the competitive side of the film and how you guys thought about it? And did you get passionately into that competition?
You know, it's funny you say that. You know, we did, and in no way would I ever compare it to Hoosiers, and that movie is unbelievable. but we were talking about, you know, I loved when Gene Hackman, you know, moved to this town, living in Barbara Hershey's house, and like helping her sort of, you know, walks out when she's tilling the field at one point in the middle of the winter, and you just realize that he's just so not in his element. You know, where was he before? And we talked about that specific aspect of the character, because that character is a little similar to Adam Jones, actually, in a way, what his arc. So, I really love the idea of what does he do at night, Adam Jones? Because he's not sleeping with women, he's not doing drugs. Well, he's definitely not getting 12 hours of sleep either. So, you know, what does he do? You know, that's sort of what Hackman does in that house. So we had him walking around London, looking in shops, like constantly obsessed. So that was, you know, and what made me think of that was Hoosiers. But yeah, it's very much, you know, I mean, the Reese character, you have this nemesis, this other guy who's competing and hiding just how competitive one is. But then we see that little sort of slice of his personal life and he's completely destroying his restaurant just because of a decent review that his old partner got.
Yes, ma'am. You. Oh, sorry.
There's a beautiful connection between creating a meal and creating a relationship, and I thought that was just really lovely in the film.
Oh, wow.
Also, sense memory when you eat a specific meal. I was wondering what your favorite meals are that might draw a sense memory out for you.
It's so hard. We've obviously been answering a lot of food questions, and there are so many different types of foods, but for me, there's something really comforting about my mum's roast chicken.
Yesterday I had a fried black rice, and I'm half Spanish, I don't come from Spain, my mom does that a lot too, and at the test, it was spectacular, in a restaurant called Estella, yeah. Boy, the crispy fried black rice.
Yeah, I guess a classic Sunday roast, it's always kind of something that kind of reminds you of home and comfort and being a child, I guess, which is lovely. Yeah.
Brad, you know, the thing about food is, if you throw out any food, I'll tell you what the memory is. I mean, that's the great thing. It really is true.
Sunday gravy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, grandmother. Pulling it out of the freezer and freezing my hand because it was so cold. Because we used to freeze the gravy, you know, for the week. She would make it on Sunday, and then we just stack the freezer with it.
I think that's the thing about food, though. That's it's just so much more than eating for me, and I think for anyone who appreciates it and like lives to eat, which somehow all of us pretty much do. But the idea of like everybody getting together around food and what that does for relationships and friendships, and it's like kind of the most joyful thing about being alive. So it's a difficult question to answer, you know.
Well, the family meal share was probably the most crystallized moment when you were finally on the team.
Right.
It was when everyone realized, oh, yes, you can have dinner with us. And there was a satisfaction on the whole team, very much like when you have dinner with your family and everyone all of a sudden shows up, oh, wow, we're all here. This is something really remarkable. And nutrition becomes more than just comestible. It becomes emotional, and there's something to that in a shared experience, particularly when you go through a dinner service and work so hard together with people you don't even have to love every day, but you need them then. And then at the end, you can look back at each other and say, yeah, we did it. We just
came. Do you do that at your restaurants?
Yeah.
Because I never had that experience. We never had the family meal.
We have in all of our restaurants, because we're lunch and dinner, we have breakfast, lunch, and dinner family meal.
Oh, that's amazing.
You just stop in.
It's so important.
And the late dinner family meal is like the 12:30 leftover bits of steak put in the pasta with everything. And
right.
That's the best. Yes.
Actually, Mario, this question is for you, but the other members of the cast can add in as well. When it's after an entire day of working with very expensive ingredients and all sorts of fancy techniques, when a chef goes home and cooks for himself, what does he like to eat?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I like very simple things, and it's almost always based on product as opposed to technique. So a simple duck egg from the farm market, over easy, with a slice of fontina, and as it is in season right now, some shavings of white truffle. Just make you feel... Right? Yes, I'm the loon, but I'm the king of the loon. And that's, you know, for me, it's the simple stuff. Or whatever, you make a quesadilla, and you put some interesting stuff on it that you've got. Leftovers play a big part of my favorite things to eat, because you're not going to sit there and grill a whole steak at 1 o'clock in the morning. But if they had steak at the dinner table at the house, because I'm home at 6 o'clock every night for dinner, and then I go back to work. So I know what there is in the fridge when I'm thinking about what I'm going to eat.
Wow.
Yes, ma'am.
Do I need a mic?
I don't think so. We can hear you.
Actually, this is for Mario, but anyone else, feel free to chime in. What do you think about the whole thing about chefs being rock stars these days? And are any of you enamored with chefs that you felt like, oh my God, you know, this is somebody really cool that I'd like to meet?
Well, when I became a chef in 1978 in New Brunswick, New Jersey, at Stuff Your Face Restaurant, cooking was what you did after you got out of the army, before you went to jail. Because it was a task that anybody could do. Peel potatoes or be a part of that world. And in the subsequent 30 years, as we've watched, food has become more than just something you ate on your way to the theater or after the game or between something in the opera. Food became the centerpiece, and it's whether it's because it's entertaining to watch people cook or entertaining to go to their restaurants, we've elevated the players, whether it's the winemaker or the chef or the maitre d' or the bartender, the mixologist or whatever, they're all... they've been elevated because it's really fun and really relaxing to watch someone who really knows what they're doing do it. Even if you never intend to ever do it just like that. Like porn. You just happen to watch it and I might never do it like that, but I'll probably watch it again. The same thing with food. Like the whole fascination with nutrition and satisfaction come together in one place, and it's a fascinating thing. So, of course chefs are, but I think that the next rock stars are going to be like the farmers. Who allows the chefs to be the greatest? It's the one who produces that particular gem lettuce or that kind of oyster or this delicious kind of beef or this magnificent chicken that tastes so much better than all the chicken you ever tasted. And their ascendancy, I think, is imminent. That's because we need to understand that we need to get back into our agriculture a little bit, and that heroism will be remunerated by paying them the proper amount to get a really good chicken.
But do you think also the term rock star, just this, when I was just doing research, you know, that White Heat, that cookbook that came out about that this photographer, photographer had taken this a bunch of photographs of this young chef, amazing. And there's that one photograph where he looks like Jim Morrison with the cigarette tank.
And a sturgeon on his lap.
I
mean, it's crazy.
And you just think, oh, there's this sort of, you know, this mythical figure.
Right.
So it really was like a moment in time.
Well, when people saw that, they suddenly thought, hey, maybe being a chef is kind of cool.
Right, exactly.
Before
it all changed.
That was in the back of
it. It was the hat that's like 5 feet tall.
You know, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Or the guy in the, you know, in the Italian guy t-shirt smoking a cigarette up by the dumpster.
Right.
What's up for dinner tonight?
Right. Right. And to have a guy like that talk about food in such a passionate way, I'm like, you're like, oh. That was like a whole new
thing. Well, that was my first real mentor, Marco Pierwet, and I remember just thinking, the world is now suddenly something far more interesting.
Yeah.
He would take little tagliatelle and take oysters and put them in a little bit of the broth with a little bit of butter and then caviar and some raspberry vinaigrette and then put it back in the shell and put it under the potato and be like, Mom never made spaghetti like that.
And this is a guy...
It was so intoxicatingly interesting.
And this is a guy who got 3 stars and at that time had never cooked in France.
Right.
Which was like, and he was making French cuisine.
Never been to France.
Yeah, and got 3 stars.
He was poor guy for 3 stars.
Yeah.
And the youngest.
And the youngest, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
This question is for the movie cooks on the stage. Being around food so much while you were making the movie, did any of you gain weight? And if you did, what did you do to lose the weight or to not gain the weight in the first place?
Yeah, I think we all have to be pretty careful about
kind of came on the floor that I was on set, and all that kind of stuff. Because you constantly, I think, like, they're constantly eating the chefs, constantly chasing, constantly kind of, and, you know, myself and Sienna were by a particularly...
I was drinking that beef sauce.
Yeah.
Remember? It's basically butter, but it was so... I just had to
Yeah. Yeah, you certainly had to be careful of it, yeah.
At the same time, you're working so intensely, and it's physically really exhausting to be in that environment. It's boiling hot, so the kind of anxiety and adrenaline and focus that takes is probably burning off the beef sauce.
I was in the process of losing weight to do a play, and so I was trying to lose like 40 pounds for The Elephant Man, so it was kind of a nightmare to do a cooking movie in between. But if you do watch the film again, you'll see scenes where my face is like 2 inches wider than other times, because we shot out of sequence. But it was kind of nice. He was lumbering, and I don't know, it felt, I'm glad that I had that weight, actually. It worked, I thought.
I gained 2 pounds watching the movie.
Yes, to the red man.
Hi, this question is for Sienna, Bradley, and Uma. What were you? What scene or part of the movie do you think was the biggest challenge, and what was the most fun?
The biggest challenge for me was the scene where Bradley and I had that confrontation, where he called me an infection. There was just something about the atmosphere on that day, and I think having worked together so intensely on American Sniper, and we'd sort of got to a level of trust with each other as actors where we could just kind of get quite deep quite quickly, and it felt very intense, very real, and I think it just really affected the environment, and one of those things that was kind of cathartic and very interesting and very dark, but hard to go through that with someone that, you know, with your friend. And then we had this kind of enough of a good relationship and of a good understanding of each other to be able to avoid each other for the rest of the day without having to apologize or explain why. But it was just a pretty real moment. And then at the end of your day, you're like, that was a great day, because that's the weird thing about being an actor. Like, the horrible stuff is what makes you feel good. But the best part of it for me was the training and learning these skills and being around this incredible cast. We all became really close, and we laughed a lot. And we worked in a kitchen. We were chefs, and we really did it. There was no doubles, as Bradley said. And to have that experience of really living another profession is one of the most exciting things of our job, I think.
I mean, I just had one scene, so...
Two. Three.
No. But anyway, it was a pleasure. It was just fun. I just enjoyed myself.
Yeah, that scene was pretty brutal with Uma.
Yeah, we cried the whole time. So second half of the day.
I think the scene with Matthew Rhys was probably the most shocking one. That's at the end of the movie when he shows up at his nemesis restaurant. It was late at night, and we didn't have much time, and the bag thing just sort of happened in one of the takes, and then, you know, it just feels vulnerable when you're doing something like that in front of 12 people that you don't know at all, the chefs in Reese's restaurant. But ultimately, it was beautiful because Matthew Rhys, who plays Rhys, was just incredible. We didn't really know each other at all. And then next thing you know, he's, caressing me and trying to calm me down. It was really kind of... And we're bonded forever. Matter of fact, I haven't really seen him since. And I look forward to seeing him tonight because we looked at each other after and we're just... It was like why we both love doing what we do is to be able to really put yourself in imaginary circumstances and hope that accidents like putting a bag on your head and realizing you can kill yourself happen. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I had no idea until I saw the movie about this idea of food trends, that, you know, you can come back after a few years and everybody will say, the way you were preparing that's all wrong today. You're doing it all differently. So I wanted to know from the actors if there were any food trends today that you sort of dislike or hate or think are stupid. And for Sienna and Uma, being fashionable people that you are, your aesthetics
about fashion. How do trends influence that?
Aesthetics about fashion and what? And
how do trends?
Trends and fashion.
I think it's very important to avoid trends. But, you know, that's just because I'm new. Because I've been doing it for so long.
Yeah, I don't really follow kind of like, oh, that's the cool thing to wear, and, you know, I sort of have an aesthetic that I like. I'm sure it's the same as everyone sitting at this table. You know, you kind of wear what you think is nice, what makes you feel good. And food trends, no, I think I try anything. There's nothing that I feel... first of all, I'm not particularly aware of them.
But they make a big point in the movie of saying...
Well, the sous vide, I think that food is... Yeah, I think sous vide stuff is delicious, but I also like barbecue stuff. So.
Green shirt, sir.
Hey, guys, congratulations on the movie. I really loved it. It's like a great mix of like a dramatic film and like chef's table-esque food scenes that look beautiful. I wish there were moments like this to watch. You know, a lot of us won't get the chance to talk to somebody like Marco or Marcus. I was wondering if Sam talked a little bit about the tips and the tricks that you learned as a chef. If there was one thing that you'll take away from this set as far as a food hack or a kitchen tip that you'll be using for the rest of your days, and maybe Daniel about getting a table. And Bradley, I love how you treated the suite in the Langham. Is that mimic at all how you are with your real hotel room? You and service everywhere. And all.
No, I'm the opposite.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, not like, yeah, I would feel horrible if I left a room like that. Yeah. Spoon, we were talking about this yesterday. You know, I always thought spoon was the sort of bastard utensil. Bastard child on the utensil. It's the most, it's the optimal, most worthwhile and essential element to any cook if they're going to cook. And I did not know that before. And also the great thing, Marco and Gordon talked about plating food and just, you know, once you make a choice, live with it. Don't, if you ever see a chef, you know, serve, and then it's over.
Yeah.
It's like, and they were so clear about that when I was plating food in the movie. I thought that was really interesting. You know, see, have your vision, you know, improvise with it, and then that's it. Would you agree with that?
Completely.
Yeah, yeah.
Once you second guess yourself in any craft, you're...
Yeah, it's over. Yeah.
Yes, sir. If there was one thing that you would take away...
Oh,
yeah,
I just learning, being taught how to cook fish... which is like a simple, delicious thing, but really easy to get wrong. And I now have a pretty solid and well-rehearsed technique as to how to cook fish pretty well, and it's impressive. At a dinner party. So that's good.
Hi. One of the things that keep coming up in the movie is that there's a lot of emphasis placed on pride, respect, and validation for one's work. And this is a two-part question. If any of the cast members want to answer this, who or what gives you validation or pride in your work? And the second part of the question is, can you talk about John Wells' directing style in this very, you know, Asian movie?
It seems like chefs live and die by critics and judges, and I mean, actors have very different feelings about that. So I'm wondering who or what gives you validation for your work?
I personally, I'd say being able to having a good day's work. I'd say feeling like I have given it my all, and being with people like the people up here, and feeling that we actually created something together. That gives me great fulfillment. And somebody like John Wells creates an environment where that can happen. For example, when I was just mentioning the scene with Matthew Reese, I mean, you have to have a very a director that knows exactly what he or she wants and is really inviting the collaborative experience. Which is for me, all the years that I've worked, the best directors are the ones who are the most collaborative, always. And he was like that, and always willing to hear from everybody, and treated every single person with the same value. It was the guy who was a real cook who was in the back. If he had an idea, he would listen to it just as much as if I said something. And that's those aspects of a director, that you want to gravitate towards people like that.
Yeah, I think it's the validation question is complicated because it's... I think if, you know, it just depends, you know. It really has to come from somewhere in you, and I've certainly had experiences in the past where I felt like on that particular day maybe I didn't show up to the degree that I wish I had, and it's hard to feel fulfilled regardless of what the response is to that. I think you really have to know that you've done everything you can to put everything you can into what you're working on, and that in itself is validation, because ultimately it is a question of taste, and these things do ebb and flow, and people like stuff and don't, and I read reviews of films that I adore and they're terrible, and vice versa. It's just not personal. It's, you know, everybody has their own opinions. So I think you have to kind of turn down the noise on too much praise or criticism and just do your best.
I find it other actors and other creative people in films too, but when another actor... it's nice to you. it's very, very moving. You know, sort of surprised, like, oh, really? Yeah, thanks. sort of, it's people who really understand what it's like. It's most impactful sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Finding truth in moments as well is always a lovely thing. Like, you know, it could be a look, it could be anything. You know, but if it's a genuine thing, you guys will feel that, and as a result, it will resonate off you, and then the audience will feel it, and I think that in itself, even if it's not fireworks, is validation enough to make you all do the job.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. Two more questions. The back, ma'am.
Yes, Mario, this question is for you. You spoke on the 3-star Michelin. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, how does one become one, and what are the aspects of becoming, you know, after they become one, what makes the judges so great in their critiques?
Well, the Michelin Guide is very anonymous. We never know who they are, and they present it a little bit in the movie like they could have kind of figured it out, and maybe in Europe it's a little bit different, but the Michelin Guide in America is a little harder to figure out, because like Del Posto has 1-star, and the Spotted Pig has 1-star. So if you come from another town, and you're using the book, and you're thinking, well, I just went to the Del Posto, let me go to the Spotted Pig, you might be surprised, or discovered. Because it's an entirely different experience. So the judging is something we're always trying to figure out, and, you know, we don't really get to question them. But it's certainly a prize, and one of the things that we do in the restaurant business is if we're not treated well in a guidebook, we tell all our friends, no one reads that fucking book. But if you're in the book, oh yeah, this is probably one of the most influential. So we're always trying to crack it, but at the end of the day, and it goes back to the validation question, we're really cooking for ourselves in our kitchen, and we're really just trying to figure out how to share that experience in the best way that we find it exciting, knowing and paying attention to every cook in the world and finding out what they're doing and what's going on in the ingredients. And a lot of customers come in and they don't really care about any information at all. They want something to eat, they really want to talk with their friends, and they really don't want to talk to a waiter or hear about the chef's passions, because they're just there for something. Mm. So finding a way to bridge all of those options is having great front of the house staff who can read the customer and say, these people are really interested, maybe you want to go talk to them. Or maybe these people don't really want to hear about anything, don't go near their table, like they're busy. And that's kind of what the guidebook kind of rewards, is our ability to make that experience seamless for any level of different kinds of groups of people that come in. But fundamentally, we're cooking for ourselves, and we're building a restaurant so that we are most impressed with what we do. And, you know, that's the validation when we look and other chefs come in and say, wow, that was a good thing. That was great.
Yeah.
Last one, ma'am in the back.
Yes, for the cast members, what kind of tippers are you? And Mario, what do you think of Danny Meyer's no tipping policy in restaurants?
Let's hear about the tippers first. I'll bet you these are all very good
tippers.
England is really bad with tipping. It's just not in any way a part of the culture that it is here. And it's often it's included, but it would be 10%. Mm-hmm. And if it's not, you know, you can be as generous as you want. But like in a taxi, you don't have to tip. It's just different. I guess the wages are maybe higher and that doesn't balance out the same. But here, like, yeah, that's where people make their money, is on tips. So you better be conscious of that.
Same in Germany, it's 10%. So it always takes me a day until I understand. I always get these strange looks.
Oh, no, as soon as the American waiter hears a European accent, they're like,
oh. So true. That's so true.
Oh, here's one for the house. And to that answer, that's why Danny Meyer is taking this on, because what they're doing is they're changing the minimum wage. It used to be that you could pay a waiter $4 or $5 an hour, and they would still make $70,000 or $80,000 or $100,000 a year because they would be being remunerated by great tips. The idea of the good side of that is that you'll work hard because good tips are clearly a part of good service. The other side is that the whole team's working just as hard, and in a team player guy like Danny Meyer, it would seem that everyone should share in the upside and that they should all be a part of it. It's a way of, Danny's trying to get his hands around and his head around keeping the restaurant business sustainable, meaning that the business can profit and continue to do what it does in any way against the different kinds of things that are changing in the world while we try to figure out how to equitably distribute any kind of money for the people that are deserving of it. So it's a double-sided knife and a three-sided coin and a five-sided conundrum. And he came out first, and that takes a lot of balls, and I look forward to seeing how he figures it out. Of course, my team's been working on this for 5 months, but we were not prepared to come out as the leader of the pack in this one. We've got to really think this out and really kind of do town hall meetings, not only with our staff, but with our customers to figure out exactly what they
think. So Del Posto might follow suit?
I would say if there's the first one, that would be the easiest one to do because it's a prefix menu there. Del Posto will probably be the first one that follows some kind of a line of what we're going to call servicio incluso. Yes, last question.
Just to follow up on your question.
Yes.
Bradley, you've come out in support of Jennifer Lawrence's comments about wage equality for women, which actually kind of parallels your character's growth in your in his relationship to women, treating them as equals. Would you like to comment on that, on stepping forth? Congratulations to you on that.
Thank you, but I don't. There's nothing to really congratulate. It was just sort of. I mean, if anybody's congratulated, Sienna, who took a stand, a very huge stand. Not to put you on the spot. Anyway. all I was saying was that it's a tricky thing to talk about money. I'm never aware what anybody else gets unless you're approached to give some of your money because, to make a movie is getting harder and harder and people are paying less and less and people are always taking pay cuts. That's my experience. So the only time you ever find out about somebody else is if you have to divvy up the pie differently so someone will come on and do it. But, you're not aware of what other people are getting also. So why not just be transparent and say, okay, if here's the pie, let's divvy it up and let's talk about it.
Thank you.
I mean, wage equality is unassailable, just like marriage equality is unassailable. These are things that in 40 years we'll look back and be like, wow, that's just like not letting people on the bus. So it's inevitably that it's going to happen. It's just a question of who's going to take the heat on the first day or the first prize, and then it'll all kind of settle out. It has to. It's natural. It will be equal to everyone. Thank you all.